Accession number 28735, Reel 1.
Eric Rink, Reel 1. Can you tell me where and when you were born, please?
I was born in Lambeth, South London, South West London, I suppose, in 1922, March the 26th. Which occurs in one of my later stories.
What did your parents do for a living?
My father came from the Isle of Wight originally, Cowes he was born. And I don't know when he came to London. I think it would have been a few years before World War I, because he joined the Yeomanry, the TA as we call it now. And when the war came, he was called up. And now I would have thought, looking back, my father coming from Cowes, he was interested in yachting, boats, sculling. He left school at 14, he sculled around in with one oar at the back of a boat in the Medina, Cowes Harbour, you know. I would have thought he'd be in the Navy. And yet, eventually, I get a picture of him from... I don't know where I got it from. I suppose it must have been after my mother died, and we went through some of the family album, as it were. And there was my father in khaki wearing puttees astride a horse in France in 1915. And I thought, what the hell was he doing in the army? Why wasn't he in the Navy? The answer was he joined the yeomanry, hadn't he? And he didn't know war was coming, and so he had no choice. He had to go and ride a horse in France. But he had come to London, met my mother, who came from Buckinghamshire. How they met, I've no idea. He got a job with the post office as an ordinary postman, cycling with his sack around him and a shako type of helmet, which goes back to the 30s. Now they wear the normal sort of peak cap, which is common to most organisations, but the old shako was, you know what I mean by a shako? It's got double peak, one back and front. A very quiet man, except that he was musical. He played a banjo and he played it very well. In fact, when I got old enough to realise what he was doing, on Saturday nights, he used to join four other banjoists, and they would put on a banjo team and play for dancing at a local hall, just like a pop group would these days, yeah. Except that it wasn't recorded. And there was a lead banjo and accompanying banjos and so on. And so when we had parties at home, Christmas time and what have you, birthdays, it was a very musical occasion, because my dad would play the banjo. He also, when my mother sang, as she did, apart from playing the mandolin, she had a good contralto voice, a little bit harsh when she pushed it, but nevertheless quite good. I say this as an ex-choir boy. Therefore, the parties were musical, and Dad would accompany her on the piano. But you see, he'd never been taught, he couldn't read music, and I have inherited the same thing from him. I can go, as have done, played in pianos, full grand pianos on some occasions, pub pianos on others, and I used to be able to sit down and play for 4 hours from memory. I probably play the tunes like, you know, T for Two or something in the wrong key, because I've never read the music. I don't know what key it's written in. Nevertheless, parents, my father and mother, had a quiet life apart from the musical side and so on. They weren't well off, I don't suppose. They couldn't have been. My father, at best, I imagine, round about, let me think, 1932, shall we say, earned £5 a week, which was a bus driver got then. But surprisingly, we lived on that. We even went to Cowes on holiday on it every year when it was regatta time, and the Royal Yacht Squadron up went the halyards and the flags went up and the cannon went bang and all the yachts crossed the line. Marvellous. I grew up with this sort of background. The other thing I didn't appreciate for some years, when I was too young, was that my father had a shed that he'd built at the back of the house in our garden in Stockwell. And Stockwell Station, it's been in the news recently. We were half a mile from Stockwell Station in Lambeth. My father had this shed, and in it he made model yachts. Most unusual, and in fact most talented, because apart from getting the design, eventually he made small ones. I say small, 2 or 3 feet long. Eventually he joined clubs, model yacht clubs, and he went up and finished up building 6-foot-long models of 6-meter yachts and 9 feet high. And my father did everything, built the whole lot except for the sails, which my mother had to make on a sewing machine because he couldn't use a sewing machine. But he filed all the little fairleads and the cleats, tiny little pulleys and so on, filed them out of solid brass and put them all on. Only when I went to art school, and this is 1938, did my father deign to ask me if I would paint the waterline along on one of the boats and some imitation planking on a hatch cover. Of course, I was at art school and I could do that sort of thing, jolly clever. So we've had a really happy life with my parents, and we never owned a house, but we were always in rented accommodation. Gradually we moved from Stockwell out to Balham, out to Range Park, which is really Surrey, just going south, over the years just preceding the war. In fact, I started the war itself living at Range Park.
What about your education? Your early education?
I should say, apart from that, of course, they had 4 children, of which I was number 3. So I had an older brother and sister who were separated by 7 years from me. They were born in 13 and 15. I was born in 1922. And I had a younger brother who was born 2.5 years after me. So the 4 children, Dad, going on holiday with this gang, troops and on buses and trams. he was a very quiet man. I've never known him lose his temper. The only time he ever hit me was with the strap of his belt, and that was because I'd made my mother cry for some reason or other, whether I'd messed my pants or I wouldn't know, but he knew, and therefore he said, go and stand at the foot of the stairs, and then off would come his belt, whack across my backside, up to your room. apart from that, strangely enough, I never really knew him. I never really talked to him. One didn't in those days. I'm not so sure whether he'd do now, actually, but I never talked to him personally, and strangely enough, although I used to, when I, during World War II, when I'd become a naval officer, and I'm sure he was very proud of the fact that I had, one could tell, but he never actually asked me what it was like. He never asked me, why did I do this, or what did I do? Never asked for any details at all about the flying side, which I found, looking back on subsequent years, somewhat strange. One would have thought he would have wanted to know, in a sense, but no, apparently not, no. So, he died, he lived through the war, but he was 67 when he developed the cancer of the throat, I think, and had some remedial treatments, radiology, That would have been in 1948-49 period, because I got married in 49, and he was not able to go to the wedding because he died about 3 weeks previously. There is a picture of him in the album there, but that's irrelevant probably from a word point of view. No. Other than that, don't know that I can say much more about my parents, you know.
What about your education?
We three boys, I had a sister, of course, she went to different schools. We three boys all went from Stockwell, just over half a mile away, to St. John Bowyer Church, a small English church school, from the age of four, I suppose. Might have been five, I'm not certain. I think it was four. Anyway, we were there until we were 11, and all of us, in our turn, passed the Junior County Scholarship, as it was called. And that would entitle you to go to grammar school if you wished. And since my elder brother, who he was cleverer than I was, particularly at mathematics, he became an electrical, in fact he became Sainsbury's chief engineer eventually, but that's another story. He was sent to a school in Brixton Hill, not far from the prison actually, but nothing to do with it, which was called the Strand School, because it had been originally in the Strand in London. It was something to do with King's College, London. Anyway, this school was the Strand School, a normal British grammar school. And you had the school uniform, and I went there on the tram. To start with, and eventually I cycled through Brixton and so on up Brixton Hill and to school. Previously, my brother, elder brother, had been there ahead of me. And of course, if you are a brother coming up, you're put into the same house as he was and so on. And so the housemaster knows you because he knew your brother. And my brother was also cleverer than me, so when I wasn't as clever as he was, I wasn't thought that much of by the housemaster. But when I showed what I could do on the football field, which was in defence, so I was a good centre-half at the age of 12 and 13, cross-country running, I won one or two races. I won the high jump at the school sports at the age of 14. The housemaster began to take interest. And when it came to cricket, we played mostly house matches on Saturday mornings in the summer. And although my father had tried his very best to show me how to play a straight bat, he didn't succeed because he wasn't a very good teacher. So I was never very good with a bat. I mean, my highest in those days used to be about five runs in an innings, that is to say. But bowling was different because I was tall, I was lithe, and I was accurate. And there were two occasions when I did the hat-trick on Saturday mornings, bowled three of them out with three balls successively. And that entitles you afterwards, the housemaster who was present, of course, took you to the canteen and bought you a glass of lemonade. Yeah. And that was something, you didn't say a word while you were with him, of course, but he was saying, very good, Rickman, very good. Do that again next week if you can. So I worked myself fairly well, physically speaking, at school, although I was never a big, strong-muscled lad. More of a cross-country runner, you see, five miles, that type of thing. I enjoyed my time at school very much, learnt a lot. great deal. I mean, they don't just mean science and Latin and things, but how to keep your head, how to take orders, how to do what you're told, how to think what you were doing when you were told to do something as to whether it was the right thing or not. Eventually, it went into the cadet corps, so once a month you dressed up in putties and khaki and travelled on your bike or tram through Brixton to school, and everybody looked at you thinking you joined the army or something. That was, of course, cadet corps. Most, well, all grammar schools had them, I suppose.
What type of things would you do with the cadet corps?
Oh, just general square drill, marching and so on. Learn Morse code. That was quite fun. And we had little carbines. Don't know where they came from. I suppose it was a British gun, but I don't know. It didn't matter. And with those, not only could we just do some rifle drill, normal shoulder arms and, you know, older arms, what have you, but you could shoot at a target. Not bullets. They were 2.2s normally, but they were fitted with a little light in them, so you could aim at a target which was, say, 6 or 10 feet away, and a little spot would show. Don't know how they did it, but it was very technically advanced, I dare say, for the time. And consequently, the last year or two that I was at that school, which was 1936-1937, I went away to camp with them, cadet camp, which was held down at can't remember the name now. It was near Deal anyway, in Kent, and which is, of course, one of the Royal Marines bases. And although we were doing sort of imitation warfare, field games as it were, by day, you know, A team against B team, you go out and one lot would hide and try and attack you and catch you, and you would bang two stones together to sound like a machine gun. It was all just good fun, and you learned again how to keep orders and operate with others in a team and with a body, different from football and cricket in some ways, but the same basic teamwork approach, which of course is I would think vital for successful living in any stage of life, at whatever, to be able to get on with other people. To be able to play what part you can in any undertaking that arises takes what? I suppose a certain quality of acceptance that maybe I can help in this thing. You don't say these things necessarily, you don't maybe even think them, you just do them. Which is why, of course, some teams of people get on very well together and some don't, yeah.
How useful was it for, say, your later career with the Fleet Air Arm? Was it a good preparation, would you say, for a kind of military service?
I would say a very good preparation, basically. When I was... I was at art school, actually, when war started. In fact, funnily enough, I was down here at Westwood Ho, only a mile from here, because a friend of mine from the youth club in Stockwell, we'd said to each other, let's do a cycling tour of Devon and Cornwall, youth hostels, you know. And on September the 1st, the two of us left London on our bikes, and we cycled 120 miles to the first stop, which was Malmesbury. And we spent the night there in the hostel. We cycled on to Minehead the next day, September the 2nd, and stopped there, not very far. And then the next day, even less, we cycled to Westwood Ho. We would have gone further, but there was a strange thing happened. I hadn't seen the sea for some time, and I said to my friend Ira, "Oh, look at the super sandy beach. I'm going for a swim." And he said, "Well, I can't swim. So there's a cafe over there." He said, I'll park the bikes outside the cafe. You have your swim, and you could come back and get changed, and then come in the cafe, and I'll be in there having a cup of tea." So I did exactly that. And when I sat down beside him and got a cup of tea, it was just on 1 o'clock, and the cafe owner turned on the wireless and said, "We have just declared war on Germany." September the 3rd, it was, 1939. And we said, "Oh, cripes, London's going to get bombed tomorrow. We can't go down to Cornwall. We just have to go back as quickly as we can." Damn, I thought, "You bloody rotten Germans, they spoiled my holiday." Of course, we cycled back, and the war didn't start, really. There was that strange phase when we were at war, but nothing happened. I don't know for how many weeks, but it didn't happen for some time.
Were you still at art school at that period of time?
Yes, I was. And two things, I suppose, to mention, that I was at the art school. It was at Clapham, actually. Halfway between Stockwell and Clapham Common. Clapham North was the place, Edgeley Road. And I had gone there in 1938, September 38, and started a grounding first year course out of three that I was to do. And that worked fine until 1940. And the Heinkels and the Dorniers came over and blew the roof off one night. Yeah. So when I cycled there from Range Park, which was 8 miles away, up there the next day, and there was a wreck of an art school. And I was told to go home and wait for a letter that would come from the London County Council as to what they were going to do. And what they did was there were about 5 art schools in London, each of which had half a dozen students at, because most of them had been called up, of course, you see. 17-year-olds hadn't, which I was. And we were told we would be evacuated as a group, about 30 of us, to Northampton, which eventually we were. And I spent a year or more up there. Now, prior to that, prior to that, I had been at art school, and I thought, what can I do to help? Oh, I know, I can join the Home Guard. It was called the Local Defence Volunteers. It wasn't called the Home Guard to start with. And I went there and said, can I join? I'm 17, and they said, well, you can't have a gun, you know, because we haven't got any anyway. But you couldn't have one, even if we had one, because you're only 17. But you could be a cyclist messenger. Would that be all right? I said, yes, yeah, sure. So I became the cyclist messenger for the Home Guard, whose headquarters was a big double-fronted house in Grand Drive, big road coming down to the main Kingston Bypass Road, in Range Park, opposite which was a common called Cannon Hill Common, and funnily enough, there were cannons on there, only they were anti-aircraft guns in wartime, in rings of sandbags, you know, 4.5 guns, about 5 of them. And I was out, my job was of an evening, was to go round to a number of men in my platoon. I think it was, platoons were 12 men, I think it was, 10 or 12. And I was to go round their houses, say round about 6 o'clock, if the air raid siren sounded, and find out whether they could report to headquarters immediately. And then I have to ride back when I've gone round that 10 or 12 hours to report to the sergeant and say the six men are turning up, or eight, or only five, or whatever. And on one evening, I was doing exactly that. I'd finished my round, and I was on my Raleigh bicycle, drop handlebar, had the first derailleur gear that ever came out. Cost me £6, that bike did. And I, the Dorneys and the Heinkels were droning overhead. The guns were firing up at them. Shrapnel was tinkling on the road all around me as I was cycling around the back streets of Range Park and then onto Grand Drive itself. And I remember looking down off my drop handlebar bike and seeing a lovely piece of shrapnel. It would be about 12 inches long, jagged and gleaming bright brassy metal. I thought, oh, that made a good souvenir. I'll go and pick that up. And I stopped and grasped it and let go with a shout, because it was not quite red hot, but I didn't realise the heat involved. So I had to abandon it. There's no way I could cool it down. So I got on my bike and rode back to headquarters. Now, headquarters had a double gate on the front and then a 30-foot drive up to the front door, up some steps and so on. And as I came to these double gates, I would slip off the saddle, down on the crossbar, splay my feet out sideways, brake with my right hand and reach out with my left hand to undo the little hook on the top of the gate so I could go through without getting off the bike. Then I came down and I slipped off the saddle onto the crossbar, splayed my feet, reached out with my left hand, and I knew no more. And when I came to, I was inside the headquarters, lying on a bench, and the old sergeant was saying to me, can you move your right arm, son? Can you move your left arm? Good. What about your legs? Can you try moving your right leg and your left leg? Can you move your head? Right, good. Right there. Now, gently try and sit up. And I said, where am I, sergeant? How did I get here? Never mind, he said, let's make sure you're all right. Can you stand? And I said, I think so. I stood, and he said, well, you seem to be all right. I said, yes, but what happened? He said, well, I'm sorry to tell you that one of the 4.5 guns that was firing at the Heinkels, the shell had gone up to 25,000 feet and it had come down again, but it hadn't gone off. It fell down and it exploded in the road about 15 feet behind you. And it blew you and your bike 30 feet onto the steps. We found you on the steps just outside, having heard the bang. He said, I'm sorry to tell you, your bike's bit damaged. I hadn't got a scratch, a bruise, a graze or anything. Quite extraordinary. That was my introduction to war, you might say.
What was the Home Guard like?
Difficult to say. I didn't really know that much about it. I didn't take that much in part. I mean, you did the normal sort of foot drill. We didn't have any rifles, so we couldn't do much else. We did, all we had was a tin hat and an armband, you see, which said LDV on it, Local Defence Volunteers, when I joined. I suppose two incidents, somewhat light-hearted.